I want you to imagine just for a second that you are sitting down for a really simple, cozy tea party.
Oh yeah, the full setup, like mismatched porcelain, little plates of food.
Exactly. You've got the fresh sugar cookies, the smell of honey and lemon in the air. It is the absolute picture of domestic innocence. But then, right between pouring the Earl Grey and passing the napkins, you accidentally crack open a geopolitical conspiracy from a magical realm.
Right, which definitely redefines the whole concept of a lazy Sunday afternoon.
It really does.
But honestly, that contrast is exactly why the narrative logs we're digging into today are so compelling. We're looking at a gathering at Harcourt Manor involving three very different girls.
Yeah, quite the trio.
Right, so there's Agatha, who is an older girl acting as a sort of caretaker.
Yeah.
Then Eleanor, who is an actual fae from the realm of Mirari. And Alice, who is this young, incredibly earnest blonde girl.
Right.
And our mission for this deep dive is to unpack how a seemingly innocent fairy game intersects with actual high-stakes magical history, and how the active imagination might literally be shaping reality.
Okay, let's unpack this because the setup itself is just, well, it's charmingly awkward before it gets heavy.
Oh, absolutely.
Like you have Agatha struggling to pour tea from this odd clay tea set that was left behind by the manor's owner, this Mr. Kooning.
Which is a whole situation on its own.
Yeah, and you have little Alice practically drowning in this oversized wicker chair. It makes her look like a tiny monarch, you know?
Yeah, holding court in the sitting room.
Right, and they are trying to explain human technology to Eleanor, the Fae girl. At one point, they're looking at old black and white photographs, and Agatha has to explain that early cameras weighed 20 pounds and were essentially powered by gunpowder.
Which is such a wonderfully disarming moment. It really grounds the scene.
It does, but the pleasantries don't last long at all because sitting right there on the coffee table are two items that completely change the trajectory of their afternoon.
Yes, the artifacts. This is where the narrative shifts from a quirky cultural exchange to a full-on historical investigation. The girls are examining a flute engraved with a rose, which Agatha found hidden in the nest of a Jew, which is a particularly nasty sort of minion in this lore. And right next to it is a tarnished brass hand mirror that was rather casually given to them by a dragon.
Which, if you know the genre, is a massive red flag.
Oh, major red flag.
Right. Like, dragons do not just hand out tarnished brass vanity items unless there is a very good reason.
Exactly. They aren't known for their charity.
No. And Agatha, thankfully, doesn't just treat the mirror as a pretty antique. She treats it like a mechanical puzzle, which is brilliant.
She really does. She starts probing the ornate scroll work on the back.
Yeah, testing the lion's head and the paws that decorate it. And under a bit of pressure, she finds a cleverly concealed hinge. Like the lion's arm is actually a latch.
And what's really fascinating here is the deliberate, mundane camouflage.
Right.
When the mirror pops open, it's lined with satin. It holds brass hair combs and some ribbons, just totally normal stuff.
Just standard vanity things.
Exactly. But tucked away behind all that is a packet of delicate yellowed letters tied with a pink ribbon.
Wow.
And the sheer historical weight of those letters, it really cannot be overstated. They are dated in the second year of Mirari.
Year two. That's ancients.
Right. They are correspondence from Lord Bram of the House of October to Lady Angelique of the House of April. So we are suddenly reading the foundational geopolitical texts of this magical realm.
And the content of these letters is just intense. Like Brahm writes about building the Palace of All
Which
Seasons.
is a massive undertaking.
Huge. And he details how he actually used that exact rose-engraved flute to part a dense, dark forest so they could even find the building site.
Yeah, that part is incredible.
It is. And it wasn't just like magic lumberjacking. He played a quote-unquote melody of thorns,
Right.
which suggests that in Mirari, magic operates on resonance. You know, you don't just hack down a forest. You play the specific frequency that commands the thorns to move out of the way.
That is a really crucial observation about the mechanics of this world. And the building of this talus is sanctioned by divine or at least higher order intervention.
Wait, really?
Yeah, once Bram finds the site, an angel actually descends holding a flaming sword.
Oh, wow.
Right. And the angel grants them a sign of peace to build. But of course, peace in newly established realms is notoriously fragile.
As it always is.
Exactly. So the letters reveal this deep political betrayal. The summer houses, specifically June and July, are actively plotting with an entity known as the Destroyer.
Wait, I have to stop you there. Because if you are analyzing the political alliances of a seasonal realm, that feels completely counterintuitive.
It does seem backwards at first glance.
Yeah. Like, why would the peak of summer, June and July, ally with the Lord of Year's End? Summer is about absolute vitality and growth.
Right.
And Year's End implies death, winter, the freezing over of the world. Are we missing a piece of the political puzzle here? Why would vitality ally with its own destruction?
So this raises a really important question about the nature of power in Mirari.
Yeah.
It likely comes down to the cyclical fear of decline.
Oh, okay.
Summer knows that Autumn the Harvest Cord, which is Lord Bram's domain, is coming to strip away its warmth and power.
Oh, I see.
Right. So by allying with the Destroyer, the Summer Houses might have been attempting to break the cycle entirely. Like locking the world into a stagnant state of perpetual summer.
Or maybe they thought they could harness the Destroyer's power to just skip autumn and winter altogether.
Exactly. It is a desperate, treasonous gamble born entirely of fear.
And it backfires spectacularly. I mean, Bram sneaks into the Destroyer's fortress to find proof of this treason, and he gets caught.
It's a brutal scene.
It is. He's frozen solid in black stone by a single word of power. And note, it's not a spell, it's a word.
Which is a huge distinction.
Yeah, which implies the Destroyer's magic is structural to the universe, like it's baked into the fabric of reality. And Bram is only rescued because Lord Melchizedek, the Lord Protector, who is described in the letters as having a fiery mane and a horn he comes in, walks a protective circle, speaks an incantation, and then literally touches his horn to Bram's forehead to shatter the stone.
It's such a vivid image. And the trauma of that event, it pushes Bram into some very dark tactical decisions.
Yeah, he gets pretty extreme.
He does. He writes about creating these scarecrows to guard their lands against the Destroyer's minions.
Right, and these aren't just, you know, straw men in a cornfield.
No, not at all. They're actual golems designed to bring dark nightmares to life. Bram is essentially weaponizing fear to fight fear.
Wow.
Yeah, the letters paint a picture of an escalating arms race.
Mm.
And it all culminates in this final ominous cliffhanger where a dragon with a steel-plated back and a diamond-lined stomach is approaching their lands.
You know, thinking about the contrast between that brutal world-ending history and the physical object holding it, it really makes me view the mirror as this incredibly glamorous Trojan horse.
It's a great way to put it.
Right. On the outside, it's just a tarnished vanity item. But functionally, it was operating as a covert intelligence drop for magical royalty. It's like discovering a classified military hard drive hidden inside an old makeup compact.
That analogy is spot on, and it perfectly sets up the mind-bending realization that the characters face next.
Oh, yeah, because reality starts setting in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because once the contents of the letters are fully processed, Agatha, Eleanor, and Alice look at the mirror and the flute sitting right there on the table.
Right.
And they realize they aren't just reading mythology. They are holding the precise physical artifacts of that ancient war right in their hands.
Which just completely shatters Eleanor because as a fae, she knows the current calendar.
Yeah, she knows exactly where they stand.
The letters are from year 2, but Mirari is currently only in year 53.
Right. And if you are listening to this and trying to naturally map Mirari's timeline onto our standard Gregorian calendar, you're going to hit a brick wall.
Yeah, the math does not work out to an earthly mind.
Not at all. I mean, 51 years to us is just late middle age.
Right.
But Eleanor has to explain the extreme relativity of time in Mirari.
Right.
A single day, there's not a rotation of a planet. It's a spatial and experiential measurement. A day can allow a traveler to cross the entire realm.
That is so hard to wrap your head around.
It really is. And a year is certainly not 365 days. Eleanor points out that some folk live their entire incredibly long lives without ever seeing a single year end.
So how does a human brain even process that? If a 51-year gap in Mirari contains epochs of history, like entire lifetimes of war, the building of palaces, shifting seasonal alliances, time isn't just a clock ticking, it's an era.
Exactly. Time in Mirari is measured by the completion of massive epoch-defining cycles, not by the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So when Eleanor sees artifacts from year 2, she is looking at the equivalent of ancient Roman ruins sitting on a modern coffee table, completely perfectly preserved.
Then Agatha, whose brain is constantly looking for patterns, starts blurring the lines between these two worlds.
She makes a massive connection here.
She does. She points out that the human town they are in, Ainnington, has this estate called Harcourt Manor. And she deduces that Harcourt is highly likely a linguistic corruption of Harvest Court, the Court of Autumn, which is Lord Bram's court.
It is a chilling deduction.
Yeah.
because it suggests that the magical history of Murari didn't stay neatly contained in an alternate dimension.
Yeah.
The veil between worlds is porous.
Right, they're bleeding together.
Exactly. The Harcourts might be the literal descendants, or at least the human stewards, of the Harvest Court's legacy. The magic is essentially in the foundation of the house they are sitting in.
And just to twist the knife, little Alice brings out a letter she received from a boy named Thomas, who plays the Traveler in their games.
Oh, this part is so sad.
It is. He writes a very disheartening note, resigning from the court and giving up his title. And the dual reaction here is so telling.
Very much so.
Like, Eleanor is emotionally crushed, assuming he means it in the binding magical sense. And Agatha is just infuriated at him for bailing when things are getting complicated.
Right. Agatha's very practical about it.
Yeah. But here's where it gets really interesting. Because if a 51-year gap in a magical realm contains lifetimes of brutal, world-altering events, and that realm is bleeding into Aenatyn, these girls aren't just playing a fairy game anymore.
No, the stakes are entirely real now.
Exactly. The Juru are real. The Year's End is a real place that can be infiltrated. The game is suddenly a matter of life and death.
The stakes escalate immediately, and the narrative recognizes the psychological weight of this realization.
They need a breather.
Right. The girls need a physical break, so they head outside of the stables. But the deep dive doesn't stop. It just pivots. We move from analyzing historical evidence to examining the practical mechanics of how magic operates in the present day.
Right, the stables, which is such a great scene. We meet Destre, this massive, regal black stallion who snorts intelligently and is very particular about his sugar cookies.
A very distinguished horse.
Yes, and Kukon, who on the surface is just an overly enthusiastic greyhound. But they aren't typical animals.
Far from it. They are highly intelligent beings, communicating in what Eleanor calls the unspoken tongues.
Right.
And this encounter prompts Eleanor to outline the three distinct rules of Fae transformation. If you want to understand how magic hides in a mundane human town, you have to understand these rules.
Okay, lay them out for us. So
the first tier is glamour. This is a simple visual illusion. It changes how you look to the eye, but not your physical substance. If you glamour yourself as a dog, you still have human vocal cords and human mass.
So it's just a magical optical illusion. It breaks down the second someone tries to interact with you physically.
Precisely. You'd feel like a human if someone bumped into you.
Got it.
Now, the second category is much more dangerous, and those are the changers. A changer alters their form entirely, physically and mentally.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but there is a severe magical cost to this. Eleanor explains that the longer a changer stays in an animal form, the more they slowly lose their original mind.
That is terrifying.
It really is. The flesh dictates the consciousness. If you become a bird, you eventually only think like a bird. You just forget your original identity.
I instantly thought of method actors, the ones who get so entirely lost in a role, staying in character off camera for months, that by the end of the shoot, their baseline personality is fractured. Like, they become the mask.
That's a really good comparison.
But with changers, it's physiological, you know? The magic actually strips their mind away. It makes you wonder if being a changer is considered a punishment in Murari or just a deeply flawed branch of magic.
That's a great question.
But then there's the third type, which avoids this flaw entirely.
Yes, the shifters. Mm. Shifters are the masters of this magic. They have two completely natural forms.
Okay.
Eleanor gives the example of Sir Bruin, who is a werebear, or the Lord of December, who can shift into a great wolf. Because both forms are native to them, shifters retain their full minds.
Oh, that makes sense.
Right. They don't lose their identity. And because their consciousness remains intact, they can project the unspoken tongues very clearly to anyone who knows how to listen.
Hmm.
Destre and Kuon clearly fall into this higher tier. They are conscious participants in the world, merely wearing a different shape.
So Kuonot isn't just a happy dog wanting a pet. He's actively tracking the conversation.
Exactly.
But breaking down the mechanics of shifting sparks a massive realization for Agatha and Alice. They've been spending all their time pretending to be Lady Redmayne and Princess Angel.
Right.
So Agatha asks the logical question, is there pretending its own type of magic? I mean, if shifters are basically masters of wardrobe who change their physical exterior but keep their inner minds, are the girls unknowingly casting a psychological spell just by holding these personas?
It is a profound inquiry into the nature of intent.
Yeah.
And Alice recalls a piece of advice from Mr. Kooning, the mysterious owner of the manor. He told her that imagination has the power to make things real.
Which is such a loaded statement now.
Completely. And Eleanor, despite being native to Murari, admits she doesn't fully understand it, but she feels the weight of it. She concedes that this symbolic shifting, the act of holding a persona in your mind so fiercely that it alters your perception of reality, might carry a unique, undocumented magic all its own.
So what does this all mean? It completely reframes how we view childhood make-believe. It's not just play, it's a metaphysical exercise.
It really is.
But the narrative doesn't just leave this as an abstract theory. It transitions into providing concrete proof of how ancient magic uses these mundane, domestic concepts to hide in plain sight.
Yes, this next part is incredible.
We follow little Alice back to her home, the Westfield residence, for dinner. And the whiplash is incredible. We go from discussing the neurological decay of shapeshifting to the most chaotic, normal family dinner imaginable.
The contrast is deliberately stark.
Totally.
You have Alice's dad, Dean, sitting at the table, still covered in car grease from working on the station wagon.
Classic dad.
Exactly. You have her mom, Martha, managing the household chaos. You have her teenage brother, Gabriel, relentlessly teasing her. It is aggressively, almost defiantly normal.
Yeah.
But Alice is on a mission. Armed with the knowledge of the missing Lord Protector from Murari, she wants to find out exactly who bought her favorite stuffed unicorn. An old toy she named Lord Mel.
Because if the Lord Protector is missing, and his name is Lord Moth Cheesedeck, and he has a horn, Alice is connecting some very terrifying dots here.
She's incredibly sharp for her age.
She is. So she asks her dad where Lord Mel came from. And this is where the facade of the mundane world fractures. Dean Westfield has absolute total amnesia about this toy.
And it's not just typical parental forgetfulness. The discrepancy is highly specific and glaring.
Right.
The teenage brother, Gabriel, explicitly remembers the events. He remembers dad placing the toy in baby Alice's crib with a tag on it. And the mom, Martha, absolutely insists that Dean bought it. But Dean genuinely cannot remember picking it out, buying it, paying for it, or bringing it home.
Yeah.
There's a surgically precise blank spot in his memory regarding this one specific object.
Wait, if an ancient magical entity can wipe a memory to insert himself into a home, why not wipe the mother's memory too? Like, why leave a discrepancy that could be noticed?
That is the genius of the magical camouflage.
Oh.
Think about it. Wiping everyone's memory of the toy's origin might create a recognizable magical void, a localized paradox that other magical beings could track.
Ah, like an anomaly.
Exactly. But leaving a mundane domestic disagreement. You bought it. No, I didn't. You must have. That is the perfect cover. It disguises a magical intrusion as standard marital miscommunication.
Wow. It preys on adult fatigue. That is brilliant.
It really is.
So Alice, refusing to let this go, goes up to her room to find hard proof. She is digging furiously through her toy box, physically pushing past her other toys. She moves past the doll named Miss Fire. She tosses aside the stuffed animal named Baby Cat, looking for the original tag.
She's fully investigating at this point.
Yeah. And finally, her mom comes in with Alice's baby book.
Get down.
And tucked inside the pages, preserved under cellophane, is the tag that was originally attached to the unicorn.
And the physical evidence of that tag is the smoking gun that validates everything they learned at Harcourt Manor.
Everything clicks into place.
It does. The tag is written in beautiful, elegant calligraphy. It is decidedly, definitively not the handwriting of a grease-covered mechanic named Dean Westfield.
Definitely not.
And the text reads, "For Alice, from your father, a faithful protector, always."
Oh, man. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the letters from year two described Lord Melchizedek as the Lord Protector. Eleanor confirmed he vanished from Murari. So the evidence here is overwhelming. This ancient magical warrior who used to shatter black stone with a word of power shifted his form into a child's stuffed toy.
It's unbelievable.
And he did it to watch over Alice, the girl who holds the imaginative persona of Princess Angel. And to accomplish this without being detected by the destroyer, he manipulated Dean's memory to seamlessly insert himself into the human world.
The tactical brilliance of it is astounding. It completely upends our traditional expectations of high fantasy magic.
Yeah, you don't expect this.
Right, because the magic in this lore doesn't assert itself with lightning bolts, massive glowing portals, or dramatic battles in the town square. It slips quietly into the overlooked spaces of domestic life.
Right.
It becomes a beloved toy in a crib. It becomes a dog in a stable. It becomes an old man fixing a house.
It is the ultimate survival strategy. Like, think about it. If you were an ancient guardian being hunted by the Lord of Year's End, why hide in a dark cave in the mountains where you can be cornered?
Exactly. You'd be a sitting duck.
Right. Hide as a child's security blanket. You get to literally sleep next to the person you are protecting every single night. And the entity hunting you would never think to look in a suburban nursery. It uses the pure, unquestioning acceptance of a child and the exhausted blind spots of adults as a cloaking device.
It really forces us to synthesize everything we've unpacked today. The narrative is highly cohesive.
It really is.
We started with the unearthing of the Year Two letters, which established the brutal history and the looming threat of the Destroyer. Then we explored the nonlinear relativity of time, proving that this ancient threat is overlapping with the present. We defined the mechanical rules of shifting, establishing that a consciousness can survive inside a completely different physical vessel. And it all converged on the revelation that the Lord Protector utilized those exact mechanics, leveraging the power of a child's imagination to hide in plain sight.
It's just a masterful piece of world building.
Huh.
But it also begs the question of why this matters to you listening right now. Obviously, we aren't suggesting you go interrogate your childhood teddy bear.
Probably not necessary.
Probably not. But it does challenge you to look at the mundane world differently. How much of what we casually dismiss as child's play or a kid's hyperactive imagination is actually a deeper, unfiltered intuition about the way the world works?
That's a great point.
Alice knew Lord Mel was her protector long before she understood the geopolitical history of Mirari. She felt the truth of it before she had the facts.
Which leaves us with a lingering thought. We've seen how an ancient magical entity can hide for over a decade as a faded stuffed unicorn, relying entirely on the predictable forgetfulness of adults to maintain his cover and keep a child safe. It makes you wonder if protective forces do hide in the things we love the most, what deeply cherished object from your own childhood might have been quietly protecting you all along.
I am definitely going to go look at the boxes in my attic with a lot more suspicion. Keep digging, keep questioning the world around you, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.